accession number 3771, Reel 2.
Professor Weissenborn, Reel 2.
No, I went to the academy and I did a word with my house, with the housekeeper at the academy, who was a reliable elderly man whom we know for years. And he said, "Oh, Dr. Weissenborn, did you have any row or argument with the maid?" And I first thought he means the model at the academy, which was very fashionable at the time. I couldn't remember, but I immediately pressed him. He said, "Oh, no, don't talk about it." I said, "No, you must tell me what was on." And then he told me that the Gestapo had been at the academy and tried to find out more about me. And perhaps through the evidence of all the employees, they didn't ask my colleagues or my director, of course, but they sniffed underneath, under the little employees. But anyhow, they must have said, given quite a good evidence about me, so nothing happened. But these things happened with other colleagues as well, that they tried, the party member, the Nazi party member, tried to undermine and find out something about a professor whom they disliked and whom they want to get rid of. Well, that was actually the only time that I really was involved in such an affair.
How actively were you involved in politics?
Not at all. I'm not interested in politics. I wouldn't say that I'm not interested in the outcome or that I'm a fool, but I think it's a waste of time, especially if I'm not a politician myself, to make protests. Because I remember even that I thought it would be good to make a protest against what goes on in Germany under Hitler. But it would have been just, I met a number of foreign people, even in this country, or French people, and they said, "Oh, we are very delighted with Hitler," and so on. So it would have been almost foolish to protest as a private man, because nobody would have taken any notice whatsoever, especially as the top people were definitely not against Hitler as they could have been.
Was the growth of fascism and the current state of Germany reflected in your art at that time?
I don't believe in political art. Political art becomes, in the end, almost a caricature. I mean, any good artist has a mission or a moral, definitely, but it need not be expressed in a swastika flag, or a mother with four children, or a red flag, or fists lifting up. Whatever I've even seen recently, again, exhibitions of art of revolution or political art, and I find it boring and has nothing to do with art whatsoever. It is only a kind of a silly repetition of boring propaganda. I wouldn't say that there haven't been some outstanding artists who have made cartoons in this country or even in Germany, but I'm personally not interested in that kind of demonstrations.
How did you obtain your permit to come to Britain?
To get the permit here. I got a number of recommendations from Germany to several high-ranking people here and institution, ICI, Oliver Simon, Monotype Corporation, and so on. And I visited them, and they gave me so excellent recommendations that it would be of advantage for this country to have a man like Weizenborn working here, so that I got the permission to work here within, I think it almost was 3 weeks. But it was, of course, only the permission, you know, it was not a guaranteed work. But I must say I'm very grateful that that went on so smoothly, and all the people concerned were very helpful and delightful to me. There, it's never forgotten.
Was there any trouble about your wife coming with you, your wife and son?
No, there was no trouble. My wife was at that moment... I went, left Germany because, I left Germany before Christmas 38, because I knew it could happen that I would get, as I was about 40 years old, I could get a new call-up papers for military service. And but I knew that I wouldn't get it before Christmas, so I left alone and came over here, and I wasn't called up. But soon afterwards, I think I got papers, but of course then I was already domiciled here and I could send them back. There was nothing happened. And my wife, there was no problem. It was only the problem of the dissolving and transporting furniture. It was a small coincidence with my son, because he was at the time when my wife was already here, he was still in Italy and he has no passport. But that was in the end very easily solved through a cousin of my wife who just brought him on his passport over. So that was no problem whatsoever.
Did you have any feeling about coming to live in Britain, since, after all, you'd been fighting against Britain in the First World War?
Oh, not at all, no. I mean, fighting, if you are forced to fight in a war, that has nothing to do with your emotions. You just, to survive, you have to fight. It is more difficult not to fight, because if you're not, anyhow, at that time, if you not fight, you will be imprisoned or something worse. So that is almost, and I wasn't definitely, I can tell you that, I was not an enthusiastic fighter, but I was perhaps a good soldier, and I was physically fit, and that actually, I must say, the fighting, or let's say the war campaign, the marching, the on, that did me less harm than the training, the so-called barrack drill. That was disgusting, that you suddenly had to give up your freedom, your thinking, and you had to become a machine. That was, to me, almost unbearable, but still I could stand it. I survived.
Did your parents have any difficulty or unpleasantness staying behind in Germany after you left?
No, not at all. There was no reason. The only unpleasantness which I still experienced was my father was a professor in Leipzig, and he, when Hitler came to power, to show his loyalty to the democratic ideas, he joined the Socialist Party, in the, almost the last moment, which I wouldn't have done it, because if you fight against treachery, you should not fight with honesty, or that doesn't count. But he was came really into trouble, and attacked him at his school where he was working. But anyhow, I went to one of the men who was in charge, and I said, "How dare you attack my father?" My father went as a volunteer when he was 40 in the First World War, and now you attack him for joining a party which was completely legal. So how can you attack him? Anyhow, it was then in the end, nothing happened. But anyhow, you could see what could happen if you showed your character under a dictatorship. But that is everywhere the same. I mean, that goes on and on every day. That's why I actually can't afford to spend much time in political thinking anymore. It's too idiotic.
What happened to your wife's family?
My wife's family, they immigrated. They were very well connected. They had great connections to... they had all the business connections in Great Britain. He was very well known here. He was parent-in-law were fur traders. They had connections in New York. They had connections in Moscow, in London, in Paris, Buenos Aires. So there was no problem whatsoever. They just left and lived. In the end, I think they first went over here and then they went to the United States.
How much trouble did you have settling in a new country when you came here?
Actually, it was not much trouble. The only trouble was that I came here, but it was not much work to be done because I remember I had some connections or recommendations, and when I went to some firms, publishing firms, and I showed something, they said, oh yes, it is much better, your design, than we have so far. But why should we change it? Our old design goes just as well. So that was a little bit of an attitude which I couldn't grasp. So that not the best counts, but if it goes, well, let it go. But then, of course, that was soon changed because then the war broke out, and the war, of course, changed everything. And then came the most unpleasant affair, that was the internment.
Could you tell me about your tribunal?
Yes, when the war broke out, and as there were quite a number of German or Austrian emigres here, or residents here, there was, I can't remember anymore exactly the date, but it was, I think, soon after the outbreak of the war. And we, everybody had to go through a tribunal in order whether he could, to find out whether he could be free, interned, or God knows what to do with him. And there were three categories. One was enemy aliens, another one was undescribed, and the other one were definitely friendly aliens, persecuted. So I had a number of very good witnesses. One was a friend of mine, William Carter, with whom I'm still on best friendly terms, who vouched for me. And the other was a student of mine, Dennis McGaw, who was for a time studying at Leipzig. And he knew my attitude towards the Nazism very well. So I had one or two of the best witnesses. So I was classified friendly alien. I think it was C,
yes.
Category C. And but in spite of that, I think it was when the Paris fall or shortly afterwards that quite a number of people were rounded up and sent into internment camps, and I among them. And I even, and in anticipation of that, I had asked some friends, do anything to get me out, because I visualized that as the most horrible period of my life. And it, indeed it was. It was not so much if it, the treatment in itself, that was quite fair and human, no doubt. But the fact alone to be imprisoned was to me something which is beyond my endurance. I could almost, even fighting is to me less horrifying than being imprisoned. But I couldn't help it. And of course the worst was that I expected that we would be there for the duration, and that if Hitler would come over into this country, or he would be victorious, that we would be handed over as a whole batch to him. And that prospect was to me almost with a concentration camp.
How much notification did you have that you were going to be arrested?
None at all. I was living in Notting Hill Gate. I had my little flat there, and I have been working. I started a new venture of wood engravings, which was very interesting to me, and I was busy. And then one morning, two police agent came and knocked at the door and said, "Make yourself ready, we'll take you off." So off we went. You know. And we were first sent to Booth Mill, which was a disused cotton mill somewhere near Manchester, which was rather unpleasant and muddled, because there were not enough accommodations. There was the water were running through. We were sometimes almost inches in water because there was no drainage. But the washing water taps were about a dozen for about 2,000 people, so you can imagine what it was. And the cooking, you had to wait hours before you got anything to eat. So it was very depressing. And of course, the uncertainty, you didn't know what it was. And of course, the behavior of the inmates, their meanness and fear, and God, what no, is it? That was frightening. But
you mean the behavior of the other internees?
Yes, it was a kind of a fight each for himself. It wasn't settled yet. If it were settled, then perhaps then that became better. But as nobody knew what was going to happen, are we staying there, are we going to send abroad or not, and the not very sufficient or unorganized food supply, so everybody was nasty to the other man. That is quite obvious. That happens almost everywhere. But that didn't last too long. I can't remember, perhaps hardly a week. And then we were transported to Isle of Man. And then we came to Douglas, Isle of Man, which was a square, middle-class houses, were normally boarding houses. And we were put in behind barbed wire, but in the middle was a green lawn and rather little, dull little houses. But anyhow, it was clean, it was more or less organized. And the first day when we got our ration, we were distributed in little houses. I got into a house which was comparatively small, and we were asked who would like to take over the cooking, the kitchen. So being rather in an excited state, I thought it's probably the best thing to have at least something to do. So I took it over. And the first ration distribution, I realized that the food was plenty and good. Anyhow, definitely good enough to keep one healthy and alive. And remember the first day we got herrings, Manx herrings, which was fantastic. And I grilled them and suddenly, the whole atmosphere in the house changed. All our inmates said, "Oh, Weissenborn, these herrings, the best, that tasted like trout." So they were absolutely enthusiastic. And from then on, I was, of course, favored in the house, because I did not only cook the lunchtime on the breakfast, but even for evening meal, which was otherwise rather meager, in, if you only made some tea. So I cooked some big broth, and because we could get vegetable, celery or something. And I made every evening a big soup so that everybody was really satisfied and had enough to eat. That, of course, helped my position enormously.
I think the psychology of hunger, or perhaps even of fear of hunger,
yes,
is very interesting.
That is very interesting. That's very interesting. I remarked that in the Isle of, in Worth Mill, when an old man who had a lot to eat, but he opened his parcel, and we had about 10 yards of string round, unbound it, ate a few bites, and then wrapped it up again and put it, sat on it at the end. That was unbelievable. Later in my house, when they saw there was enough to eat, then even people gave me occasionally, let's say, a pound of lentils, which they couldn't eat anyhow, because how could they eat the lentils without? But before, they would rather let the lentils get stale or bad before they gave it to the community. That is a very, very interesting psychological factor.
Was this the time at which you forbade them to have bread in their own room?
Yes, that was the same time. Well, as soon as I realized we had enough to eat, I told my inmates in the house, don't take any bread up to your room. You can eat as much bread as you like, to tea or breakfast, as much as you like. But don't, I was quite categorical in this respect. But because I knew if they take a slice of bread up, it will be stale and they throw it away anyhow. And during the night, nobody needs to eat a slice of stale bread. It's not necessary. So they were very, in the end, actually, they were quite grateful to me.
Was there plenty of food throughout the time you were there?
Plenty of food?
Yes. Was there plenty of food at Hutchinson Camp throughout the time you were there?
There was. It was interesting. I will report a few details. One, some of a neighboring house came to me. It was a doctor so-and-so from Berlin. He was had a big printing firm in Berlin, and he said, "Oh, Weizenborn, I'm continuously hungry." And then I said, "I can't understand that." Then, you see, because it was then in his house, the management was not well done. And I, at this moment, I told him, "Look, I can't understand that." And I opened our kitchen stove, and I had a chicken in there. But that was, of course, illegal, because that was smuggled in from one of our boys who were allowed to go farming during the day. But that didn't last very long, only a few weeks, because then they soon found out that they smuggled chicken in, and it was stopped.
Were you and your wife already separated by the time you went to the internment?
Yes, but just shortly before I was interned, my wife, we had a small argument, and she that was a tragedy or the grotesqueness of the life, that she followed the advice or the urging of her family, and she left me. So I was, when I was interned, I was already living apart. And to make it worse, my wife sent me the divorce proceedings into the camp, which was not very pleasant, I must say, especially as I was not allowed only allowed to write one letter a week. So I couldn't even defend myself to a lawyer. But that is forgotten, and one shouldn't become sentimental about these affairs. They are finished.
You mentioned looting by soldiers, by British soldiers. Was that at Wharf Mills?
That was partly Wharf Mill and partly... that was Wharf Mill. I think it was Wharf Mill. I don't think it happened in... I think it was Wharf Mill, as far as I remember. That was pinching, perhaps. I put it as mildly as possible. If I had a few cigars or a box of cigars, and they just say, "All right, we don't need them anymore," or something like that. What can I do? And then other little things. I had a pocket knife, which couldn't really do any harm. That was about 2 inches long, and these things disappeared. So just I heard of other parts, but I wasn't involved in that. So I heard of one man who did something with typewriters, but that is another affair. It just doesn't concern me.
Yes. Yes, he was court-martialed for that, I think.
I think, yes. Did you hear about it?
Yes.
You heard of it, yes. Yeah.
Did these soldiers, who were your guards, think that you were all Nazis?
No. I think they were more Nazis than we were. No, they didn't know. I think the guards were all very, very pleasant. There was no problem at all. They behaved perfectly normally and pleasantly. No, there was quite, I think it was almost a very friendly atmosphere between guards and no, I don't think there were any occasion there, of course, continuously certain things. Sometimes the commander called me to the camp because I had made a lino cut. And I think I made a spirit of Christmas flying over the camp. And he misinterpreted it and thought it is cloud of miscontent or something, I don't know. Anyhow, he called me, or I heard of him that he complained about something, so I had a word with him, but it was perfectly solved in a friendly way. But then, of course, the pleasant or the hope was that after about 6 months internment, there came this white paper out where some categories of internees should be released. But the first one were, I think, dentists, because they were needed, and then people who had an allotment or agricultural worker. Now, almost everybody tried to convince the authorities that he had an allotment, even if it was only a...